Welcome to our new podcast series, Accessing Justice, which is hosted by CommuniCourt. During the series, we are going to be talking to a number of guests about how fair access to justice really is for people with communication difficulties. A courtroom can be a terrifying and confusing place for most people, but it can be even harder for people with a condition that may affect their communication skills and understanding. This could be someone with a learning disability, a mental health condition, ADHD, autism, or a speech impairment. Joining us for our next episode, we are delighted to welcome Lucy Reed, a family law barrister and author of the legal blog Pink Tape. Lucy has worked at the family bar for more than 15 years and is passionate about helping people to understand what happens in family courts. Lucy helped to set up the Transparency Project, a charity that works to improve the quality, range, and accessibility of family law information available to the public. She is also the author of a book called The Family Court Without a Lawyer, a handbook for litigants in person. Lucy, welcome to Accessing Justice, and thank you so much for finding the time to talk to us. So, understanding what is happening in a courtroom is often hard enough for a member of the public. But if you have a communication difficulty and emotions are high because your legal proceedings involve your children, it can be impossible to process or participate effectively. Is there enough understanding of respondents in family courts with communication issues?
I think it's probably a bit of a mixed picture. In care proceedings, everybody is represented or is generally represented. And I think professionals are therefore, between them, much more likely to spot any potential cognitive issue or communication issue, and then to ensure that those are assessed and all the necessary adjustments are made. And I think also in that type of court case, because there's usually been prior involvement from the local authority, a communication issue may well have been picked up beforehand. It might even have been assessed before the court case begins. So I think because of that context, professionals working in care proceedings, by which I mean lawyers and social workers, are usually, I think, pretty alert to those sorts of issues, and they either are able to adapt their own communication or know when they need to ask for specialist assessment and support. I say that, of course, but not all communication difficulties are immediately obvious. They can be quite well masked, but I think the antenna are usually up in care proceedings. I think in private law proceedings, where quite often there aren't any lawyers, or at least one person won't have a lawyer, I think then it can be quite hard for a judge who's probably under quite a lot of time pressure to identify and deal with those issues alongside everything else that needs to be done. And again, probably a communication issue might well be difficult to distinguish from the sorts of difficulties that many litigants in person will be experiencing or displaying in the course of the hearing anyway.
Yeah. And just then you mentioned about getting assessments. You know, if you recognise that someone needs additional help or may need a further assessment, what's the process for you in achieving that?
Well, if it relates to my client, then my solicitor has said, I think there might be an issue here, or I have identified in communicating with my client that there might be an issue, then usually what would happen is you would discuss it with your client, you would discuss it with your solicitor, and if it is felt to be appropriate and necessary, then make an application for an assessment under part 25 of the family procedure rules. And that might be, it might be a cognitive assessment if it's thought that there might be a cognitive issue that's behind difficulties in communication. It might be a capacity assessment if it's thought that maybe those difficulties are pronounced enough to mean that your client can't give you instructions. It might be an intermediary assessment if perhaps there's a known diagnosis of one condition or another, and we simply need to know how best to support the parent or the party to participate. And quite often those reports will, the person writing the report, who might be a psychologist or might be an intermediary, will be asked to give some practical proposals for how the individual can participate, both as a party in the proceedings generally, but also if they have to go in the witness box and to give evidence, how that might be most appropriately done.
And what kind of barriers do people with communication issues face in family court?
I think there are a number of them. I think they face all the barriers that litigants and litigants in person face in family court, but sort of magnified, really, because communication, I think, is probably a difficulty across the board for anyone apart from the lawyers in the courtroom, in that there's lots of unfamiliar technical language used. And also there are certain terms that are familiar, but they're used in a different way. They have a different meaning in the course of family litigation. And there is a whole big overlay of stress and the emotional content, and perhaps intimate content, I think can affect anybody's processing speed, their ability to sort of verbalise, and their ability to recall what's been said after the hearing. So, and that's not just people with communication difficulties, but I suspect it's far more pronounced if you have a particular communication difficulty. There was a study in 2013 commissioned by the Ministry of Justice that looked at the experience of litigants in person in private law proceedings. And, you know, even highly educated litigants in person, even those who are used to making presentations at work, in the context of a family court hearing, effectively fell to pieces and found it really, really difficult. So it's, you know, it's an issue across the board. And I think, you know, we lawyers tend to use technical, complex language and don't even realise that we're doing it. And often we will use understated language or really oblique language. We might not say directly what we mean, which is probably not very helpful for some people. And I think, you know, for example, somebody who's on the autistic spectrum and might really struggle with idiom is going to find potentially, unless the lawyers are really adapting their normal use of language, that there will be certain parts of what the lawyers are saying that don't make any sense to them. You know, we might talk about using a sledgehammer to crack a nut, or I can't think of any good idiom examples now, but there will be things that I think lawyers will say without appreciating it. And unless you consciously point those things out to yourself, you slip into using that language.
Yeah, of course. I can wholly believe that, especially when, even if you're making a conscious effort in conferences when you're one-to-one with that vulnerable person, then addressing the judge in a courtroom where that person is behind you and not necessarily you're representing them, it could be another party, I can believe that being quite difficult to then adjust and really think, oh gosh, I need to be conscious of what I'm saying now, not just go into the normal stride of, well, I've done this for 10 years, this is how I speak.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, sometimes I've represented in quite complex proceedings some really well educated, highly, you know, verbally competent clients, and having conversations with them after the hearing about the things that they didn't understand is quite instructive, actually, because if they've struggled to understand what you thought or assumed they would be able to process, then obviously there are going to be lots of other litigants who are going to find it even more difficult than that.
So helping people to understand the family law and court system is obviously a passion for you. What motivated you to start highlighting this issue?
I think initially I started blogging when I was quite a junior barrister. I think I was just a bit sad, really, when I started out in my career, that I found that people had this sort of really narrow, distorted view of what lawyers, and particularly family lawyers, do and what motivates them. And I sort of wanted to correct that. So I think it was initially a kind of self-defense, but it moved on from that, really, because the more that I engaged with people through the blog and through Twitter, once Twitter developed, the more I began to see that people were sort of mistrustful of the family court, and their misunderstandings about the law and practice in family courts were actually changing their behaviour and the decisions they were making about how they were responding to their cases. And sometimes that was not helping them to get a good outcome. So I think, you know, over time, I've tried to contribute to helping generally up the level of public understanding of what the law is and how the courts work, because I think it's good for, you know, the public, it's good for the individuals involved in the case, and it's quite good for the system itself, because, you know, it can offer people reassurance that the system is fair and it's working OK, if and where it's working OK. or it can highlight that things need to change, and there are elements of things that, you know, we could do better at. So it serves a really important function, both on a micro and a macro level.
So you, leading on, you were talking about the blog post. So you are the author of the very successful Pink Tape blog. For anyone who hasn't discovered it yet, how would you describe it?
Well, currently it's slightly dormant, in that I tend these days to write something and then I end up publishing it on the Transparency Project blog, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute. But it is a blog I've been running since 2007, and it covers a range of things, really, but primarily about my experiences as a family barrister, my thoughts about current issues in the family court, and as I say, it was the precursor of the Transparency Project, in that it quite often I would publish blog posts correcting some piece of misinformation in the media, or explaining common areas of confusion or misunderstanding. So one of the most read posts on the blog, which I wrote way back probably in about, I don't know, 2009, and I've updated every so often, is the post explaining the difference between a barrister and a solicitor. People Google that all the time, because it's not something that people necessarily understand.
So you then mentioned that that was a precursor to the Transparency Project, which you have co-founded. So could you tell me a little bit more about that organisation and what they do?
Yeah, so the Transparency Project is an educational charity. We started off as a sort of loosely formed collective in 2014, but in 2015 we put it on a formal footing. And the aims of the Transparency Project, without going through the very long charitable objectives, are basically to make family justice clearer. So it's taken a lot of the things that Pink Tape used to do, and a number of other people who were involved in the Transparency Project used to do, to the next level. So we've got a fantastic team of volunteers who support that work, and we write up cases where there are judgments published or there are news items about particular cases. We will explain if the news item is inaccurate or incomplete. We might link it up with the judgment and say, here's a bit more information so you can see it in three dimensions, and we'll explain the kind of law that is underpinning what's happened in that case and the outcome. And we publish guidance notes on sort of topics that people get confused about, and we've generally been working towards finding ways to increase transparency in the family court, because of course it sits in private and there's not a great deal of information that comes out, so that's part of the reason why it's poorly understood. So that might be through encouraging more publication of judgments or securing access to hearings for legal bloggers, because until 2018, journalists could attend hearings, but rarely did, but nobody else could. And as a result of the work that we've done, qualified lawyers, legal bloggers in inverted commas, are now able to attend hearings. And if the judge gives us permission, we can then publish reports about what we've observed, which we do from time to time.
That's incredible. And what have you found the response to be? You know, are people really engaging with the content that you're posting? Are people thankful that you're, you know, you're spreading awareness and kind of opening their eyes?
I mean, generally the response has been positive. I mean, sometimes people will disagree with observations we make in individual posts, obviously, but, you know, part of what we exist to do is to promote debate, so that's all, you know, that's all good. There are some structural barriers to us having as much impact through legal blogging as we would like, because, you know, we're volunteers. We can only go when we've got the time to go. Nobody pays us for going. And because of the legal framework around the privacy of the family court, until we get to the end of the hearing, we don't know whether or not we're going to get permission to publish anything. So there's quite a lot of disincentive. So we don't manage to go very often. We're hoping that when the president's transparency review is published, that there might be some adjustments that will make it slightly easier to get more people making use of that right of access to hearings, so we can get more reports published.
Brilliant. That sounds so exciting. So in one of your many, many talents, you've also managed to write a book, The Family Court Without a Lawyer. So did this come about as a result of the blog? What was your motivation for this book?
Yeah, I started writing it in 2008. just thinking back to when it was 2008 when I was pregnant for the first time. And I think I had in my mind it was going to be a bit of a, it was going to be a leaflet or a booklet. And it sort of, it got a bit big for its boots. It came out of pink tape. I was writing more and more of those kind of myth-busting explainer posts. And I was, you know, more and more alive to the fact that there were litigants in person who were approaching things in sort of unhelpful ways. And I thought they needed some steering in the right direction. I thought at the time it would be a pretty easy job, but the book, every time I've updated it, it's become sort of bigger and bigger. But yeah, it did come out of pink tape. And it was before, the first edition was well before the legal aid reforms in 2013-14, which of course made the number of litigants in person who might benefit from it shoot right up, because so many people now don't have lawyers at all.
Yeah.
So yes, I'm in the process of doing the updates for the fourth edition now.
Oh my word. It's non-stop for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my publisher is very keen that I get on with it. So.
CommuniCourt works with people with communication difficulties within the justice system and beyond. Our role is to ensure people can understand and actively participate in the process therein. To make a referral or find out more about what we do, visit www.communicourt.co.uk.
So, with all the knowledge and skills that you've gained during your career, what advice would you give to new barristers just coming into the profession? How would you advise them to use communication to change the culture of the courts?
Well, I think I would say, first of all, big words have their place, but I think simple and clean is actually very effective, surprisingly effective, you may find. And of course, it's much more accessible. So one of the things I really learned from writing The Family Court Without a Lawyer, because I had to a large extent, self-edit for a particular audience. I wasn't writing for a judge, I was writing for people that don't have a lawyer and aren't familiar with all that technical language. So I learned a process of asking myself, do I actually need that many words? Could I make that sentence more simple? And actually, that's a really important skill. And it's one that's now mirrored, for example, in the advocacy training for vulnerable witnesses that is being rolled out in terms of preparation of questions for cross-examination. You know, if you don't need that word, take it out. So that sort of process, I think, is a really useful process for all advocates, whether it's simplifying cross-examination questions or in terms of making your oral or written submissions efficient and therefore effective. So that, I think, is the first thing. And I think the second thing is really that communication is about more than words. I think your body language and your demeanour can have a really big impact, not just on the judge and their responses to you, but also in terms of building a rapport with the client and actually getting to grips with what their particular needs are, whether they're communication needs or other particular needs. But yeah, I think the signals that you send out verbally and otherwise can have a really big impact on how people respond to you. And I think in all aspects of the job, whether you're talking to an usher, a client or a judge or an opponent, I think that really matters.
Definitely. I think I would agree completely. When you walk into a room, if you're walking in quite standoffish, no one wants to engage with you. Have you found the number of people with communication difficulties in family court surprising?
I think I've probably become more alert to it over the sort of 19, 20 years I've been doing the job. I think we probably overall are more aware of the potential issues. Well, I suspect the number of people in the general population with communication difficulties of one sort or another is higher than most people might think. I mean, there are adults who might be in their 30s or 40s and a communication difficulty hasn't been picked up at all until actually they might be being assessed by a psychologist for some other reason in the proceedings, and it's picked up at that stage, and then it all falls into place and they, you know, say, oh, that makes sense now, I understand maybe what was going on. So no, I mean, I'm not surprised. I think that generally there's a better awareness and understanding of communication difficulties, but yeah, there's a reasonably high rate if you're looking for it, particularly in care proceedings, if parents, you've got a communication difficulty of one sort or another, And it might present differently according to the particular case and the individual.
And just through this discussion, you've mentioned, you know, being aware for assessments and communication. And do you think there is enough awareness at the bar about mental health difficulties and learning disabilities?
Yeah, I think it's at the bar, we're pretty alive to those issues. I think the implementation of Practice Direction 3AA helps to focus people's minds, because it places a duty on everybody to look at questions of vulnerability and access to proceedings, being able to give evidence, etc. So I think there is a, particularly amongst care practitioners, because I think they're encountering it more regularly, there's a reasonably good level of awareness of those sorts of issues.
So Communicore provide intermediaries as communication specialists to help respondents and family courts to understand their legal proceedings and participate effectively. What have your experiences of working with intermediaries been like?
They can be really helpful. I think there's still, in my experience, some variability in terms of how and when they're used and how they might approach the issues around questioning and ground rules. So some will be much more interventionist than others. So I think, as I say, there's some variability, and that may be because there is probably still a lack of consistency in terms of use of ground rules, early provision of ground rules, hearings, etc. And also because it's not always possible to get the intermediary that's written the report to the ground rules hearing or to the actual substantive hearing. So there can be a sort of change of personnel. But I think, you know, they can be really, really useful. And I think there would be some real benefit in intermediaries and lawyers sort of working together to better understand how they each operate, what their objectives are, to sort of maybe help find more effective ways of working towards a fair hearing. Because we've got sympathetic objectives as a lawyer representing one or other party and an intermediary. There's a common goal of achieving a sort of fair hearing, but to some extent what we're each doing might be pulling in slightly different directions. And I think probably understanding the ways of working and the constraints that is on one discipline compared to another probably be quite useful, because certainly in family court it's newish, in the sense that we've been dealing with intermediaries now for quite a few years, but it is still perhaps becoming established in a way that the criminal court is more used to, I think.
Yeah. And as a practitioner, would you prefer to have that, you know, an intermediary come in one-to-one and say, right, what are your objectives? Or would you prefer there to be a broad, this is how intermediaries work and this is how barristers work, let's do this together?
It's what I had in mind was a kind of sharing of professional knowledge and, you know, ways of working that might be quite useful. Yeah, as a sort of general professional development thing, rather than in individual cases, because there are all sorts of reasons why one needs to maintain a bit of professional distance in individual case. But yeah, I think, you know, we could always all learn more about one or other professional discipline that we have to liaise with in the course of a court case.
So if you had a magic wand and overnight you could change one thing about how the family justice system works for people with communication difficulties, what would you wish for?
I think I would want to see some thought given to how best to ensure that communication difficulties for litigants in person in private law proceedings are properly picked up on and dealt with. There is, under the practice direction, a duty on the court to focus on those issues. But I think it's really difficult for the court, where there's no lawyer flagging an issue, to necessarily identify the issues. So I think that's an area where I wonder if people maybe slip through the net sometimes and disengage from proceedings, because they really are struggling either to make themselves heard and understood or to absorb and retain the information and process the information. But, you know, that's my working hypothesis. But it would be good to be able to be confident that those people are not going to get missed, and that they're going to be supported reliably to participate in proceedings.
Well, thank you very much. It's been wonderful hearing from you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much to Lucy for giving up her time to talk to us. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please let us know on LinkedIn or Twitter. You can find out more about this series on Accessing Justice at www.communicourt.co.uk. Thank you for listening.